The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
We absolutely support Israel's right to defend itself in line with international law.
We need to safeguard financial stability.
2024 is not going to be an easy year.
We used to call it the dream of home ownership, but look at Britain now.
We've got to hang on to optimism and hope because it is the biggest driver of change.
Let's stop thinking of life in terms of Brexit. Let's move on and look to the future.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Lizzie Burden. Coming up on today's programme, UK business leaders are sounding more optimistic about the UK economy, and we've got a special report ahead of the budget. But first of all, Caroline, let me say, your hair is looking delightful today. Have you been on the telly?
I have been on the telly, yes. I have, because we've been really busy speaking to CEOs across UK PLC about this big thought, really, about whether levels of confidence in the UK economy are actually improving. This investigation has taken me about 2 months since the start of the year, and we'll hear more about it later on in the show. Yes, I was on Bloomberg TV to try to make this case that CEOs have made to us that actually, after hitting a kind of dismal point last year, that things are actually looking a little bit up now.
And your timing is impeccable because, of course, we've got a budget coming tomorrow. Growth's been a key focus, not just for the government, but also for the Labour Party, and how it can drive investment into the UK, revive the slumping listings environment. You've got to wonder whether this seeming endorsement from some of our most eminent business leaders means that Sunak and his cabinet have been the ones driving it.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the CEOs do welcome some of the government's efforts, like the Mansion House reforms and the Windsor framework when it comes to trade. But they also were very open to Labour's pitch as the party of business. So these business leaders are basically more reassured that the economy and growth are in focus, having been pretty much sidelined during Brexit and even under the kind of Liz Truss, Boris Johnson administrations. But most of them have got some quite serious asks. They want policy that transcends government. They want a two-term government. They want a consistent approach. So there are still, you know, big question marks, really, for whoever takes over in the UK this general election year.
That's exactly how I ask for things, flattery, and then I make my demand. Let's have a listen to what those leaders had to say now. WPP's Mark Reid told you, hopefully, 2024 is a year where things get better as things go on, unlike 2023. Simon Carter, the CEO of British Land, says he's cautiously optimistic, and more, sounding more confident, welcoming government initiatives, some of them at least, looking to the election. Take a listen.
In the UK, you learn to love the weather, you have to. But when the economy has been as clouded over as it has been recently, you start to long for any glimmer of sunshine. Last year, it was a drizzly day when I spoke to the Marks & Spencer chairman, Archie Norman, at the company's head office in Paddington. The drizzle rather matched his mood at the time. He was deeply concerned about post-Brexit Britain. Since then, we know the UK's gone into recession. So with that in mind, and the rain, of course, still coming down, I asked if his forecast is just as downbeat.
When you're running a business like M&S, our philosophy is we row our own boat, you know, and the seas are choppy or the seas are calm, but our job is to make the boat go faster. Actually, our success is more to do with how successful we are in reshaping M&S than what happens in the market. And, you know, we've had a decent run, but there's a long way further to go.
While Norman puts the success of Marks and Spencer down to the way that it's run, he does see light on the horizon for the consumer, and that will help his business and many others.
Very importantly, wages are now rising faster than inflation, faster than prices. So people are genuinely better off on average.
From the iconic British retailer to one of the country's largest pension providers, Legal & General Investment Management manages pensions for 5 million people. Michelle Scrimshaw is the CEO.
It's easier to focus on the challenges when you're looking outside the window of our UK headquarters and it's raining down and it's a grey day here in London. Actually, the UK has been an amazing home for Legal & General for over 180 years.
But what of this year or next year? Will the UK see significant improvements in growth and wealth?
So if you think about where the world is today, there is a lot of uncertainty. There is geopolitical uncertainty. There is uncertainty around interest rates. We're no different in the UK. We're part of that big ecosystem. But if I think about where things could go better, for sure, we're still in a post-COVID environment. We're still in a post-energy crisis environment. That isn't going away. It is working through. So as things work through, there is certainly an opportunity for interest rates to come down. Yes, we're in a technical recession. But as rates come down and that frees up more capital and it actually has an impact on individuals and where they are, because don't forget there's a cost of living challenge here at an individual level, not just an economic challenge for the country. I do think there is opportunity.
LGIM's Michelle Scrimshaw seeing opportunities. So is it the start of a more bullish British economy? To know that, you also have to get at the heart of what drives economic sentiment for a large slice of the UK, the property market.
If mortgage rates do go much higher, then yeah, that would almost certainly become a problem.
Property prices fell in July at their fastest pace since the global financial crisis for the third month in a row.
The housing market is on track to see the lowest level of home sales since 2012.
But although house prices declined last year, they avoided predictions of a collapse. And while office rents in the US fell, in the UK that was not the case. British Land CEO Simon Carter told me he's now hopeful.
For us, what really matters is unemployment. If people have money in their pocket, they spend at our retail assets. I think it's encouraging that we might see real wage growth. That helps because we haven't seen a lot of that. And similarly, when we're leasing office space, what matters is we do top-end office space and it's headquarters space where businesses are using it to attract and retain talent. And of course, they want to attract and retain talent when unemployment is low. So I think if we can see a situation where unemployment remains relatively low, the economy grows a little bit and we see a bit of real wage growth, the momentum that we've seen over the last couple of years can continue. Because that's been the odd thing in the property market, that the investment market, because of higher interest rates, has struggled, but actually occupationally it's been very good and people have taken space.
So momentum in the right direction, but what about some acceleration? To get that, you need to tap into the buzzword on every CEO's lips.
AI is going to be important. We believe we're excited about it.
We're addressing some of the most profound social challenges with AI in ways that are transformative.
AI is going to change the nature of jobs.
We believe that AI is the most profound opportunity in our lifetimes.
You heard executives mention the word AI about 50 times.
Advertising giant WPP's CEO Mark Read is focused on the benefits this once-in-a-generation technology could deliver for Britain.
I think it's a massive opportunity for us. I mean, at one level, you could say, well, the large language models, they're all being created in America. But actually, what you can do with AI is get access to these models extremely cheaply. You know, we're not investing billions of dollars at WPP in AI. We can't afford it. But we are using the models created by OpenAI and Microsoft and Google and others to power our work. And so it's really about the application of technology. And as you say, because we're a service-based economy, it could make our service structure much, much more productive, much, much more efficient. And I just think we have to lean into it and embrace it.
WPP is planning to spend about £250 million a year on AI technology. Microsoft is investing £2.5 billion in UK AI data centres over 3 years. And the government says that it wants Britain to be focused on reaping the rewards from the AI gold rush. Here's the Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden speaking to Bloomberg at last year's AI summit.
If you think about how financial services and the City of London have so enriched the United Kingdom over the past generation or two, I'm convinced that AI can do the same thing for the UK over generations to come.
So the government is persuaded of the benefits of artificial intelligence, but John Neal, the CEO of Lloyd's of London, says better performance also needs political stability.
I think we all need the confidence of a two-term government, whatever that government is, because I think the issues that we're grappling with, you know, and the need for confidence and the lack of the confidence that whether it's the public or whether it's business, we just need the sense that there is a plan and that plan is going to have to stretch beyond one term of government. So I would say we need change. And I'm not saying that has to be a Labour government versus a Conservative government. We do need to change. We cannot carry on the way we are.
And he's concerned that even with the attempts by the big political parties to woo the city, too much is still being taken for granted.
Our advantage in insurance is the only marketplace for insurance in the world is here. There isn't another one. And I think we are standing up and representing the best of that, or doing our best to illustrate how that value can be. We're growing, we're profitable. We need to be profitable if we're going to innovate and reinvest in what the future looks like. I don't think the same is quite true everywhere in financial services. You know, we've seen a wealth of delisting on the FTSE. We've seen real challenges around investment and funding in the UK. We need to get that back on track. You know, part of the livelihood and well-being of UK PLC is as a global financial services centre.
There's a lot of ground to make up, even with the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt's Mansion House reforms. The FTSE 100 has lagged global markets since 2008. Investors pulled a record $29 billion from UK equity funds last year. And Europe's TUI announced recently it will delist from London. Those numbers are not lost on other CEOs we spoke to. Here's WPP's Mark Read again.
I've learned as CEO never really to comment on our share price. But I mean, you can but look at your valuation relative to your peers in other markets and think, you know, there are some possible attractions to being in the US, though I think the complexities of it make it very difficult, really, in reality, for most companies. And what we really need to do is get UK pension funds investing back in the UK market, because, you know, ultimately, you know, we have a sizable stock market, and if it's not being supported by UK pension funds, you know, why would international pension funds support us?
So the UK economy is still under a cloud, and no one expects rapid growth tomorrow. But there is hope that it could stop being rained on and at last enjoy some sunshine.
Now, healthily, I think you'll forgive me for being a little sceptical about this change in tune, Caroline. I have been wondering whether what's really geeing up all of these business leaders is actually Labour's poll lead and the prospect of political stability in the UK, particularly in contrast to potential victories for Donald Trump in the US or Marine Le Pen in France. So I put this to Callum Pickering, senior economist at Berenberg, who's been touting the fundamentals of the UK economy for as long as I've known him.
UK politics has normalised in a major way. We now have what is will be tomorrow kind of a boring centre-right economic policy approach, gradually reducing the deficit, trying to curb inflation, but not all that exciting from a supply-side perspective. There'll be an election later this year when they'll probably lose to what is kind of boring centre-left. Keir Starmer is, in my view, a sort of a low-wattage version of Tony Blair. It's sensible policy, it's pro-business, there's not as much sort of Blair razzmatazz, but that's probably good for the UK at the moment. And this return to the political centre is already visible in economic activity. Business investment's up almost 34% since the middle of 2020, even though the markets are not really tuned into this story. Actually, businesses are in a major way.
So that was Callum Pickering, senior economist at Berenberg. And joining us now is your partner in crime on this story, Caroline, Bloomberg's senior economics writer, Phil Aldrich, who worked closely on this story with you over many months, and he's with us in the studio now. Phil, how much of a pinch of salt should I take all of this with? I pointed out to Callum in the studio earlier, he's got a column in The Telegraph. He works for a bank. Of course he's talking up Britain.
I mean, you just have to look back to September 2022, which was the lowest point in our recent history. And there's been quite a few low points since Brexit. Obviously, that was the Liz Truss mini-budget disaster. So the pinch of salt is that it wasn't that long ago when we were right at the nadir of political and economic life in the UK, and the world was looking at us and sort of sniggering.
Is this where we start singing, things can only get better?
Yeah, exactly. There is that. You know, you could say this is inevitable, that there is improvement, but it isn't inevitable. It's actually, you know, it could have been more drift, worse. Things could have got worse. You look at the 70s where there were, you know, periods of national economic and social decay. And the government, Rishi Sunak to his credit, and Jeremy Hunt, they seized the problem. They stabilised things. The relations with the European Union have improved, you know, considerably. Windsor Framework, you've got Stormont up and running, which, you know, clear as confirmation that this relationship is now sort of relatively stable. So you can actually move on from Brexit, which the thing we've all wanted to do for God knows how long.
Yeah, and it's not that these CEOs were rolling out a huge programme of investment with us. It was the beginning of feeling more positive, the rhetoric being there, the opportunity, the prospects for growth in 2024.
That was it. There was a slight distinction between you believe the rhetoric has changed and that there is all the signs are good, all the behaviour, all the action, all the policies are moving in the right direction. But obviously it takes time for these things to bed in. And so once they're bedded in, then the fundamentals should allow, as Callum would say, should allow for, you know, a better growth rate and a more stable economy.
Which brings me back to the politics, which after all is why we're here. If the election is in November, do you think everybody will feel rich enough to vote for the Tories again?
It's all relative, isn't it? If you look back, you know, real wages compared with the peak of real wages may still be below that level. But compared with, you know, last year or, you know, back end of 2022 when inflation was running at 11%, if you've got real wage growth, which we've had for 6 months now, we've had real wage growth for 6 months, that does make you feel better. And if you've got all these tax cuts, you've had the two national insurance cuts, now rumoured that there's going to be another two pay off national insurance. So, you know, £900 more in the average person's pocket compared with December. People will notice that, and you're seeing there's going to be some big increases in benefits and state pension and national living wage in April. So there is reason to think that people will feel better off. Inflation is falling, energy bills are coming down. And so I'm assuming this is why the election is going to be held late in the year, to give people time to have actually felt like life is better.
Yeah, and you know, the Marks and Spencer chairman, Archie Norman, who spoke to us, you know, in his office in Paddington with an M&S store right down in the basement there, or on the ground floor, was saying people do feel better off. They are genuinely better off than they were. He was talking about the national minimum wage going up, and that helps not just his customers, but actually his employees and their families. British Land CEO Simon Carter was telling us people have money in their pocket, therefore they want to spend when it comes to these sorts of retail outlets that British Land has and leases out and so on. So, yes, I think that there is kind of something a bit more concrete going on. I wonder what you were most surprised about, though, when talking to those CEOs. What did you pick out as the most sort of surprising message from them?
I think just in general, the investability of the UK, which seems dreadful when you look at stock market discount, the UK stock market discount, and
apart from the fact that it's cheap.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that being possibly one of the reasons why people were sounding a bit more optimistic. I mean, I think one of the unsaid things was the UK is cheap now, which is one reason why we're seeing an influx of foreign investment. But it did feel like the sentiment was that they do want to invest. They are seeing solid numbers, solid investment, and they are seeing genuine reason to believe in growth. And obviously, we came onto AI with that, and that was the being a services-led economy and AI being offering the promise of automating services. Economies like Germany's, which has got twice as much manufacturing, have benefited from a sort of automation of production. We could get the sort of industrial structure of the country lends itself to potentially benefiting from AI. But so there are all these kind of just this sentiment change. I think it was that change in sentiment which was striking.
So if that's the case, why do we need a British ISA or these reforms to pensions? Or on the flip side, will those measures really boost the case to invest in Britain? Do you think that they'll be effective in terms of getting retail investors to spend their money domestically?
Well, British ISA, I don't think anyone, I'm a bit sceptical about the government basically telling people to put their money somewhere and then everybody saying, oh, okay, that's a good idea, that's what I'm going to do. I mean, the big pension funds don't like it. I don't think the public likes it particularly. I mean, they're going to put their money where they see the best opportunities and where the rates are best. So if all the incentives are set up right, that's good. But it could be some kind of co-investment arrangement where the state is making it more attractive for people to, for big pension funds to invest in UK assets rather than just ordering them to do it, then that kind of incentive would work. But there is reason to, the point being that the UK is cheap, there is reason to believe that there is a case for investing. And you picked up that from John Neal and others.
The Lloyds of London, yeah.
Yeah, that there is reason to invest in the UK. It is underpriced. And if you look at the yields on like the top 20 companies in the FTSE 100, is crazy compared with, you know, historic
yeah
years.
And they were all very positive, you know, all of these businesses. Yes, they've got large footprints abroad, but, you know, Legal & General Investment Management, you know, 40% in the UK. They do a lot in terms of you know, home building, supporting home building and so on. You know, they were all sort of talking about their history, their legacy, that they are UK businesses rooted in Britain, but they are looking abroad, you know, for opportunities. A lot actually were looking to the US, Lloyds of London being one, and others saying, you know, we really need to improve the UK's connectivity and outlook, you know, when it comes to being overseas. Look, we are a day before the budget. The big concern that could potentially be a spanner in the works is just how little headroom the Chancellor actually has to deliver change for the UK, and also the pressure that the public finances are under, that national debt is under. You know, how much of that is a kind of drag to what is otherwise a more positive outlook?
Yeah, so it seems like the Chancellor is just going to bend the rules, right? He's gonna take money by promising public spending cuts that are undeliverable and spend the money up front. And you know there's a lot of people out there saying that the fiscal rules don't work, right? And change the fiscal rules, and the Tories government looks like they are going to bend the fiscal rules so that they can effectively break them without, you know, but sticking to the letter of the rule. So, you know, there is, in a way, there is consistency with people saying we need better fiscal rules, but it's doing it in a sort of rather obtuse way. If he gets 2p off national insurance and does the, you know, fuel duty cut, it's going to be about a £15 billion tax cut, and you had a £20 billion tax cut in November, so that is quite substantial.
But it barely budged the polls.
It did. I mean, the polls are the polls. I mean, they've got to do what they can do. If they choose to do this and it doesn't work for them electorally, I mean, frankly, I think a lot of people just think it's time for a change. That's another thing we picked up a lot in our interviews, was people just think it's time for a change. So the Tories are kind of damned by 14 years of government, and it's time for a change, and they can't do anything about that. But they can sort of spend $20 billion at one fiscal event of tax giveaways, and then $15 billion at the next one. That's not an insubstantial, you know, couple of fiscal events, with and all of that within 6 months. So it seems like that doesn't feel like they're being limited by the headroom, if that is indeed what happens tomorrow.
Yeah, forgive me for looking at my phone while we're chatting, Phil, but I was just looking at a thread by Torsten Bell about this, and he says we've got the fiscal rules all wrong, and actually he's not too constrained by the fiscal rules, it's other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the fiscal rules are the loosest fiscal rules we've ever had, exactly. And everybody's saying these are a massive constraint. The problem is that we've got $40 billion of debt interest payments that we didn't have. And we have got, because of the pandemic and the financial crisis, we've got a massively higher debt burden than we used to have. And because post-COVID, we've had this inflation spike, so we've got interest rates back up. You know, £40 billion is two-thirds of the defence budget. I mean, and that is going on nothing useful for the country, nothing useful for anybody. And the government has to pay that. So that is why public finances are under strain. We are running, actually, because there's a measure of called the primary deficit. So this is excluding interest payments, how much your taxes cover your spending. And we're going to be running a first primary surplus in 22-23 years on the forecasts. So this is a very fiscally prudent set of measures if you strip out the debt interest cost. But because debt interest has gone through the roof, you know, that is the massively constraining factor on the government. And so these fiscal rules now are biting harder because of that inheritance from COVID and the inflation shock.
Yeah. That's the bind.
It is. It's the difficult backdrop, isn't it, of the reality of the public finances in the UK. And yet, against that difficult backdrop, the change in sentiment from UK PLC, from chairs and CEOs of, you know, FTSE 100 businesses who've been speaking to Phil and I. Look, I think it's a really interesting moment, isn't it, versus last year when we did a big piece together, Phil, about Britain being adrift. This is all about a more bullish case for the UK. Does that play out over the course of the next few months, and how big a role will it play in the election?
Whoever said we're all doom and gloom at Bloomberg. Phil Aldrich, our senior economics writer, thanks for being with us. And Caroline, what a great report. That's all we've got time for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo. Our audio engineers were Maruful Hussain and Sean Guastamacchia. I'm Caroline Hepp.
And I'm Lizzie Burden. We'll be back with a budget special tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.